Blog Talk Radio. Firefly Willows LIVE presents Evolve, featuring your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us on this episode of Evolve, Nurturing the New in Consciousness, the Arts, and Culture, with your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney. Evolve brings you people and ideas on the cutting edge of change, opening the shells of the past to move our culture into the now. The arts and evolving consciousness are how we are bringing that change to the culture at large. Evolve brings you the wise, the foolish, and the heart-based to help us meet the challenges of the times we are in. Your host in helping you evolve is Robin White Turtle Lisney, who received her master's in fine arts from Mills College in creative writing in 2012 and her PhD in energy medicine in 2013. She is an author of 3 books, the most recent being Heart Path, Learning to Love Yourself and Listening to Your Guides. She has published poetry in many literary journals and numerous anthologies, and her poem First Step was selected for reading by survivors at the Virginia Tech Memorial Bench dedication in April 2010. In addition to her writing, Robin is also an artist whose work has been shown widely throughout the Midwest and East Coast. Robin White Turtle Lisney is a psychic medium and energy medicine practitioner through East West Bookstore in Mountain View, California, through her office in Santa Cruz, California, and across the country by phone. Robin travels across the country as a speaker and leading workshops. To find out more about Robin, you can visit her website at www.thecenterforthesoul.com. So take a breath, relax, and let yourself evolve with your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney.
Robin White Turtle Lisney, and you are here listening to Evolve, and this is the radio program that talks about the arts and healing and how we can transform our culture through the arts and through things that we do with our own inner selves. So today my guest is John Fox. John is a certified poet, a certified poetry therapist and a poet, and he's an adjunct associate professor at California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. He teaches at JFK University in Berkeley, the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, and Holy Names University in Oakland. He's the author of 2 books. One is Poetic Medicine, The Healing Art of Poem Making, and is featured on the PBS documentary Healing Words, Poetry, and Medicine. He presents at medical schools and hospitals throughout the United States and has also presented in Ireland, England, Israel, Kuwait, South Korea, and around the world. John has served as president of the National Association of Poetry Therapy from 2003 to 2005, and he is the president of the Institute for Poetic Medicine. John, welcome to our show today.
Robin, thank you for inviting me to be on.
Yeah, it's delightful to have you. So tell me a little bit about your institute and how this whole thing got started for you, because you've been doing this for a while now, haven't you?
It's been a while.
Yeah.
The Institute for Poetic Medicine was founded in, actually more recently, in 2005.
Mm.
And the sort of goal of the Institute, or the mission statement of the Institute, is to awaken soulfulness in the human voice.
Oh.
And our call, our vision, is to really help to fund projects currently around the United States that use poetry and expressive writing to help people to do that, to awaken soulfulness in their voice.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, we're interested in reaching people who are, the word these days is marginalized, or perhaps not well considered, and to give them a chance to have their voices be heard.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a direct example is, for the past 2 years, we've funded a project led by one of our poetry partners, Krista Wissing,
uh-huh.
who's an MFT,
mm-hmm.
Got a degree in expressive therapies at CIIS, where I teach.
Mm-hmm.
And Krista was actually a student of mine about 8 years ago, and we've stayed in touch. And now she's the program coordinator at the Bay Area Brain Injury Network in Larkspur.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I learned that, I got back in touch with Krista, and I asked her if she'd like to lead a project that we'd sponsor for people with acquired or sometimes known as traumatic brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the second year we've done. So Krista's led the Rediscovery Project,
mm-hmm.
and it's just completing, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've helped to fund that. And
mm.
and one of the things we'd like to encourage is, in this, as things grow, that there'd be other funding sources. So Krista has found that for
mm-hmm.
Like Bread for the Journey.
Mm-hmm.
Helped to fund it, and
mm-hmm.
we also received some funding from poets and writers.
Oh, great.
And they're going to be, the people who participate in that program are going to be giving a public poetry reading at Book Passage in Corte Madera, California,
mm-hmm.
next Saturday in the morning at 10:30.
Oh, how exciting.
And that's new. Like last year, the reading happened at the Bay Area Brain Injury Network in Larkspur. And so
mm-hmm.
they're sort of unfolding their wings a little bit more and putting this out into the public. So
that's fantastic.
So the Institute funds projects like that. And there's certainly others that we've been helping to support. So I have a training program that trains people in the sort of practice of poetic medicine
mm-hmm.
and poetry therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have be an excellent resource center for people interested in how poetry and writing can be applied in healing ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then the work that I do around the country, or abroad also, is part of the Institute for Poetic Medicine.
Uh-huh. So tell me a little bit about that work, because you've been all over the world. You've been in Kuwait and all kinds of places.
Right. Well,
tell me about that, because what is the work that you do with the Institute in terms of how you interact with the audience or the people, or do you work in small groups or with large
groups? Sometimes large groups. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big question, because there's a broad range of people and applications for this work.
Mm-hmm.
Just for instance, I mean, in terms of the work abroad or, you know, around the planet, a woman named Bahare Amidi, and if you go to Bahare, BAHAREH.com, you'll learn about Bahare's work in the United Arab Emirates.
Mm-hmm.
And she was already doing work with poetry and healing, and then put in, I don't know what she Googled, but poetry therapy or something, and my name came up. And so about 2.5 years ago, or maybe almost three now, we made contact, and Bahare sponsored me going to UAE or United Arab Emirates last December.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe, and this may be another question we'll cover, but just the art of collaboration, and that's how things happen these days,
mm-hmm.
I think, in a very effective way.
Mm-hmm.
But Bahare was doing work in UAE in the labor camps or the safe house at the Indonesian consulate, where dozens of women go because of you know, very bad situations that they might have been in. And but Bahare has gone there to tell stories and then to work with writing poems as well. And so I was a guest of hers, both at the safe house and the labor camp, working with young men from the sort of, you know, Kerala area of India who go to UAE to be part of the building trade, but also to learn English. And so the people who teach English as part of that invited us in. And it was amazing, Robin, to just to be with these young men, probably in their 20s and 30s, who one wouldn't immediately think of that be the most optimum group or the group that'd really be interested in making poems and writing, but they did fantastic. And it's very moving, actually, to just give them one little prompt. We translated a poem into Urdu and Hindi. And when they heard that, they just went with it. So that's one experience in UAE, and then certainly been some others in South Korea. Wonderful woman, Mrs. Soyoung. If you go to Google the Korean Institute for Poetry Therapy, you'd find out about Soyoung's work of bringing poetry to her country. I mean, single-handedly in a way. Well, I shouldn't say. I mean, there's other people for sure, but she has done beautiful work in bringing poetry therapy to the people of Korea, in this case, South Korea.
Oh, marvelous!
So I've been there twice to do projects that Soyoung has helped to sponsor.
Right, great. And well, the idea of, you know, poetry is, of course, worldwide, and it's been worldwide, especially in the Arab world. They, you know, we have marvelous poets, as you know, out of the Arab world, you know, Rumi and Kabir and on and on and on. And but what's wonderful about what you're doing, in my estimation, that the Institute is supporting, is showing how healing that this poetry can be with people. And that's the key that I think is a new thing that, you know, the woman in Korea and the woman in the Arab Emirates is doing, excuse me, that really makes a huge difference for people. So that's pretty exciting to see.
Right, take that approach. My sense is that poetry has always, I mean, for millennia, actually been healing. Indigenous people knew this, and older countries like Greece and China, you know, actually to become a physician, this is what I understand from my friends in Chinese medicine, you have to, your first year, study poetry. So there's a tradition of poetry as healer. Certainly indigenous people are aware of this. And ancient cultures like Greece, there's a beautiful phrase in ancient Greek called, and the word is sophrosyne. And it means beautiful language, sophrosyne, and the idea that language could bring integration and stability is what they mean by that use of beautiful language to bring integration and stability. So so there's these deep roots of language and of poetry in particular that is like that. Yet, you know, we tend to focus on the sort of literary, really the exquisite literary attributes of poetry, but also it's the fact that it's, at least in our country, not it's not a big seller. I mean, there are wonderful poets that do, that are, and poetry is becoming, in fact, my experience in the past 20, 24 years or so, our country, it's had become more prevalent. There's a lot of actually things that are going on that show this, but the idea of approaching poetry not only from a literary point of view, but more essentially feeling point of view, and how we, there's something we can talk about how that approach maybe is different than a literary approach.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because I think I know, you know, I finished graduate school just a year ago, and I brought your book in because I felt like, you know, these guys, these professors, they need to know about you. They need to know about the possibility of this. And it was pretty interesting because my professor was very dismissive. And I was like, well, wait a minute. You haven't even looked at the book. You know, he's like, ah, yeah, it's got to be all literature. So I'd be really interested. And you know, after a while, he did look at the book and talk about it. And, you know, we didn't talk about it in class, but he was willing to look at it. Which I thought was interesting, but there is a great big disconnect, I think, in the academic world with healing in terms of the arts. They totally just don't even want to talk about it. They don't want to deal with it. That's for the psychologists or it's for some other profession, but I think it's so obvious. It was so obvious to me in the critiques what was happening with the students and how they were transforming just by writing the poetry, that was quite an amazing.
How the students were going through transformation.
Absolutely, they were. I was watching, you know, kids that clearly were challenged, or young people that were challenged with mental illness, or with not everybody in there, of course, and some were very sound and very sound in mind and body, but you know, you could see the transformations of people by their acts, and I have seen that since I was in art school, you know, 30, 40 years ago. So talk about that a little, the difference between poetry as healing and the poetry as that literary component that, you know, we all turn to, like Yeats and so on. I mean, you know, certainly there's that history of poetry, nature poetry in particular, I'm thinking. But
right. Well, just this field of poetry as healer or poetry therapy, it is really comes in a very broad way.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, I have been extremely grateful for what we might call professional poets,
mm-hmm.
and the gifts that they bring to us, you know. And yet, I also recognize that writing itself for you and me, for anyone, is a lifelong process. However, mm-hmm. long that life might be given the grace to be.
Mm-hmm.
And having worked with young children, particularly in the early part of my career, but still, it's still happening, I just see that there's something more important than an adult sort of claiming their turf because of their literary acumen.
Mm-hmm.
I can share a little funny story that it draws me. I wrote a book called What You Didn't Lose in 1995. It was published. It's still in print, not Finding What You Didn't Lose.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got my favorite fan letter I ever got was, I remember reading it at the Hobie's restaurant in Palo Alto, like about early 96, because the book came out in 95. But the letter was from a person in Racine, Wisconsin, and it began, "Dear Mr. Fox, I'm 11 years old and have been writing for a while." "Dear Mr. Fox, I'm 11 years old and have been writing for a while." You know, from her name was Melissa, but bad that writing was something she could claim.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was something that had history for her.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you're 11, like 1 month is really quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But then, in contrast to that, meeting a woman in her late 80s who was in a group I had at a assisted living place in Connecticut, and mm-hmm. everyone else in the group was in their 90s, mid-90s or so. And so this woman, Martha, she was about 86. She was a young kid, kind of. And mm-hmm. but we were having a great time. Some of the people had some forgetfulness, some special kind of forgetfulness, whether we were call it dementia or Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
But just hearing the poems brought a great sense to mm-hmm. their ears.
Mm-hmm.
And I could feel it. I mean, it was actually one of the most sort of, sometimes you sit with adults and you know they're kind of trying to size you up and get things figured out.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine, but they were just having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little bit of a longer story, but when I moved towards wanting to do a writing exercise with this group of people, and what it was going to be, I was going to have them write themselves, but I had a flip chart or a dry erase board and was going to write down lines that they said about connections with gardens. But every time I moved towards that, trying to do that, I moved towards trying to do that, I could see Martha, this woman in her 80s, who was had her faculties a little bit more, and she pulled back by her body language. And she did not say, Robin, she didn't say, I don't want to write, or it wasn't explicit, but I could just feel that she wasn't into it. And so, but she was there having an enjoyable time, so I would just let go of it. And so here's where the sort of sensibility, the healing part comes in. And and then a little bit later, I thought, well, maybe Martha is a little, you know, maybe we can try this. So I kind of edged towards it, and once again, and it wasn't explicit. This is the thing. It was just sort of the sense I had that she wasn't interested or she didn't want to do it. I wouldn't say, I take back saying she wasn't interested. She didn't want to do it. So then as the group was about to close, and I wanted to let them know how much I enjoyed being with them, I let them know that the group's about to been so enjoyable to be with you. Martha leaned forward and put her elbows on her knees and said to me and to the group, I want to tell you why I didn't want to write. She said, when I was in third grade, so she would have been 8 in third grade, and she was 86. When I was in third grade, my teacher gave us an assignment to memorize a poem and to bring it in. And at that moment, she stood up, balanced by her on her walker. She had to use a walker, and her shoulders were back, and her chin was sort of up, and there was a sense of pride that was felt really healthy and very strong. And she spoke her poem flawlessly, and it wasn't haiku. It was a longer poem, and she knew it perfectly. But what I haven't told you is she said when she did this in school in third grade, her teacher had told her she hadn't done the assignment correctly and her poem would not be included.
Oh, dear.
Well, that oh dear, that sigh had become a lifelong sense of, and I saw how this image I had for Martha was that very thick pane but clear glass was between her and her access to her self-expression.
Exactly, yeah.
And it was, you know, very, and I, who knows, she probably hadn't shared that story with anybody for, I don't know, 78 years, but here I was, someone who she felt she trusted, and her peers, and so when I think back to that 11-year-old Melissa Hamm, was old and been running for a while, you know, how do we treat ourselves and how are we treated in regards to our creative voice?
Yes.
And so coming back to the dismissive men, believe me, it's not, you know, it's not, no surprise.
Yeah.
I mean, that sense that because what I'm aware of is that we need to maintain, well, let's see, how do I want to say this? That it's helpful to me in relating to people to remember that vulnerable place.
Right.
Where our voice gets smushed or dismissed early on.
Right, right.
But to me, the dismissal of that voice is like saying that your immune system doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
This writing and healing as being like another kind of expression of an immune system.
Yes.
I mean, almost literally speaking, maybe our spiritual immune system.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea. You know, how the arts really are a way that we help ourselves build our own inner immune system and our own support system internally.
Exactly, yes, and that sense of an immune system that actually can keep us whole and help us in that wholeness to discover things that we wouldn't otherwise have known. I mean, I can't make this a literal link for you, but there's a wonderful researcher, James Pennebaker, at the University, he's retired now, I think, but University of Texas at Austin, in the late 80s and into the 90s, he's doing research into what he called expressive writing.
Right.
Expressive writing, and
let's pick that up in just a second. We're going to take a break, and I'll be right back.
Okay.
welcome, and we're back now with Evolve, the radio show that looks at evolution through the arts. And my guest today is John Fox. He is the director of the Institute of Poetic Medicine, and the Institute offers grants to places that are working on projects with various populations. He is also an author. He's the author of Poetic Medicine, The Healing Art of Poem Making. And he's been featured on a documentary in PBS called Healing Words, Poetry, and Medicine. He's presented in medical schools throughout the United States and hospitals, as well as throughout different countries, South Korea, Kuwait, Israel, England, Ireland. And he's been president of the National Association of Poetry Therapy. When we left off, John, we were talking about the difference between the academic view of literature and how poetry and healing has such a different emphasis. And you gave us the story of this woman who had been wounded for all these years around something she said when she was in eighth grade, and comparing that to a young girl. I wonder... I know that I have found that when I'm teaching with people that sometimes they have to kind of get over their wounding. I just want to follow up on that question.
Sure.
Did that woman feel like she broke through something by reciting that to the group?
Well, I'd have to imagine that she did. I was there for just a short visit for that one time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the anecdote of her actually sharing that story with me and with her peers, to me was a breakthrough. And she had claimed something for herself.
Right.
And what I feel happens is that as people experience this, whether they're 11 years old or 86,
right,
and they're in a place that sort of balances both safety,
mm-hmm,
and a sense of deep receptivity, mm-hmm, to their creativity, that the healing begins.
So part of the healing is people listening and receiving their words. Is that what you're saying?
Here's the sort of stepping back a bit, Robin.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in 11th grade, I had two loves. One, I played the cello,
mm-hmm,
but I wasn't particularly good, but I really loved the cello. But I was also a writer, and
mm-hmm,
I decided that I would let go of playing the cello and go to school to get a degree. They didn't have MFAs back in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent my poems to Boston University, to the director of the creative writing program,
mm-hmm,
at George Starbuck, who had been the director of creative writing at the University of Iowa, which is sort of known as, even then I had done my research, knew that was the preeminent place to go.
Yeah, number one place in
the
country.
So George Starbuck had been the director, but he was at Boston University there, and this is about 1973. Ann Sexton was on the,
mm-hmm,
staff there, and so, but here I was applying to BU, but I sent my poems to George Starbuck when I was like in 11th grade, which sounds a little overeager, and so here's what George Starbuck did. He wrote back a letter on Boston University stationery, and there's one sentence that I remember and will never forget. He said, "It takes a long time of getting to know somebody before you can make helpful comments about their poetry."
Mm-hmm.
And that was coming from a person teaching creative writing in a,
yes,
program, a degree program,
right,
at Boston University. So what I've taken that sentence, and it's been sort of a gradual process for me getting involved in this, but say, well, what does that mean,
mm-hmm,
taking a long time to getting to know somebody? Because it's difficult to take a long time to get to know somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe what I can do is listen in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You brought up listening. Brought up listening in a way that lets me get to know them.
Yes.
And lets me them get to know that that's what I'm doing.
Right. So would you read that poem for us, When Somebody Deeply Listens to You? Because that seems to kind of go to the heart of what you're talking about.
Right. You're asking me to read this poem that I wrote about 1985,
mm-hmm,
when I had just started my training with my mentor, Joy Shiman,
mm-hmm,
at El Camino Hospital in Mountain View, California. I had found out there was a field called poetry therapy that had a whole training regimen, mm-hmm, that I was beginning to take. But I asked myself, what am I here to learn? What am I here to learn about poetry and healing?
Mm-hmm.
And this poem came to me one day.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes like this. When someone deeply listens to you, it is like not the dented cup you've had since childhood and watching it fill up with cold, fresh water. When it balances on top of the brim, you are understood. When it overflows and touches your skin, you are loved. When someone deeply listens to you, the room where you stay starts a new life, and the place where you wrote your first poem begins to glow in your mind's eye. It is as if gold has been discovered. When someone deeply listens to you, your bare feet are on the earth, and a beloved land that seemed distant is now at home within you. Someone deeply listens to you, your bare earth, and a beloved land that seemed distant is now at home within you.
Mm. Beautiful.
So that really goes to the heart of what we're talking about as healing, because poetry does that when you both speak poems and also when you write them. I know for myself, when I'm writing poetry, it isn't necessarily a choice. It's usually something I have to do because something is bubbling up out of me. And I've been doing it long enough now that I kind of know when the signs are there and I have to just sit down and do it. And it's usually now it's a daily practice. It's part of my spiritual practice to write a poem a day or to get some writing done each day. So the writing as in the process of writing, but in an interactive mode, one of the things I love about poetry is that it is interactive, and it demands people listening to it and hearing it in actually even in the formation of poems, because I know I have a critique group, and we critique each other's work, you know, several times a month, and in that process, I think the poem is pretty good. And it's pretty much there. And then we'll take it to the critique group, and they'll pull it apart, and they'll say, well, what about this? What about that? What about this? And then when I go back to rewrite it, I have their ideas, and I can lay them out kind of like a smorgasbord of what I might want to do. But in the actual process of writing it, I can keep what I've done or let it go. And I think that that's part of the process that I love about poetry, too, is that it's so interactive. But when you read that poem, what came to me was how the act of being heard is such a thing that we skip over in our culture today. You know, we don't really completely engulf listening. People are in a hurry. They want to do things quickly. And poetry makes you slow down. It makes you really listen and receive the words that are being spoken.
Absolutely.
So when we've touched on this a little bit, but how can poetry and poem making help a person improve their capacity to listen in the process of hearing other people's poetry?
Yeah, I think that...
I'm imagining you address this in your workshops and things that you do.
Yeah, I mean, it's really up front at the very beginning, because my workshops, we're not there to critique.
Mm-hmm.
However, I feel that the more we can develop a capacity to really deeply listen, the more that actually it creates a space for that person speaking themselves to get more deeply in tune with what they are really needing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a generative act. So not just for that particular poem, but for perhaps what the poem is offering to his or herself, that mm-hmm. they can discover something that they wouldn't have gotten if someone had immediately said, well, I think you ought to do this and
mm-hmm.
put up this sign and go there. And
mm-hmm.
and so the idea that that we are sort of creative people is given much more gravity and weight.
Right, and being, you know, being human beings gives us an opportunity then to be more interactive in the world rather than rushing through it all the time is, you
right.
know.
And sometimes also the things that we would think are like, there's a wonderful poem that I use in my work. It's a short poem by Charles Olson.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called These Days.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you have to say, leave the roots on. Let them dangle and the dirt just to make clear where they come from. These days. So, and what I want people to imagine is, I'm not, it's like, here I am working with, say, you know, prisoners, men who are prisoners at a hospice. They're trained to be hospice volunteers at California Men's Colony Prison. Or they're adults who are at a cancer support community and they're dealing with, you know, threatening, life-threatening cancers.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're young teens who've dealt all their lives with severe, moderate to severe disabilities, say at Blythedale Children's Hospital. Or they're, a clinical pastoral education people in clinical, going daily into the rooms of people who are quite ill,
mm-hmm.
and their families who are in distress.
Mm-hmm.
And how can they learn to be with themselves in a ways that give... give them support and
mm-hmm.
help them to sort of hold what they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you have something?
I have this idea of listening. It's something that I've focused on for a long time. But a wonderful writer, Brenda Uhland, U-E-L-A-N-D, Brenda Uhland, wrote a book in the 1930s called How to Write.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, she talks about listening quite a bit. And is a wonderful passage about listening being a generative act, like you're listening to me right now, and my listening to your questions and to what you're saying, Robin, actually is not just an act of sort of respect. I mean, there is respect there, but there's also something that makes possible something we maybe didn't expect. So
mm-hmm.
Brenda Uhland says, listening is a magnetic and strange thing, a creative force. When people really listen to each other in a quiet, fascinated attention, the creative fountain inside each of us begins to spring and cast up new thoughts and unexpected wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, that's not something you're going to hear on, you know, cable news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, not necessarily in academic settings, but it may be the foundation of what actually allows us to make room for one another in ways that are, you know, so needed these days.
You know, I'll say something interesting,
yeah.
too, in response to that, about how when I was going back to school just recently and, you know, in my 50s, dealing with the academic, I was kind of petrified to go back because I'd heard, you know, horror stories about MFA programs and how they, you know, tear apart your work and everything. And, of course, that has been part of the reputation of Iowa is that they've been very ruthless with their students. They're much better now. And I was so impressed the first that we had in the academic group that I was in, you know, 30 or 40 poets that were going to be going through this program, the director of the program stood up and said, I want to tell you how we critique here. And I was like, ugh. And the first thing she said is, we're kind to each other, and we listen, and we don't trash the professor, and we don't do this. And this is the way that we critique. We listen for what are the qualities that are positive in the poem, and then we might add our suggestions for changing the poem or making it better. And but we do the first, we do the, you know, what she was saying was like a sandwich of positive comments. And critique, and then more positive compliments about where this poem could go or what's the potential for it, which was such an entirely different experience than I'd had in some programs or in some other situations. But I like the fact that you don't critique in the work that you do in poetic medicine, what you're doing is you're listening to the poem and receiving it no matter what the language or how flowery
you know, things that we will do, like we can mirror back lines that resonate for us.
Right.
And, or we may ask questions, open and honest questions that reflect something about the how we're receiving the poem. Honest question, something that Parker Palmer, a wonderful man, Parker Palmer, does in his work with Circles of Trust and Courage to Teach, is you don't. It's a question you don't know the answer for. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to direct somebody to think about something in particular. And so how can we unpack what's in the poem? But I want to come back to just the sense of that we don't know what's there until we really are with it. And I think that's what George Staubach meant by takes a long time of getting to know somebody. There's another poem, Robin, that is... I'll say along with that These Days poem, whatever you have to say. I've used that poem These Days, whatever you have to say, leave the roots on, let them dangle in the dirt just to make them for 25 years. And I'll always ask people, what do you get from it? What and there's similar things that people will say about that. Don't have to pretty it up. Don't have to make it nice. I'm not here to please somebody else. I can leave it raw. And... so that's where it's really a different world than the sort of trying to write to get an award or to get published or be part of a school or get approval from others. It's a very different kind of approach. But the thing about that poem is that I think it's about 17 words, is that I'm still getting new things that people will say of how it speaks to them. It is absolutely amazing to me. That it's not just one or seven or ten things. It's dozens of things that that poem communicates. And so why wouldn't it be so for someone else's poem that what it's in there could be could speak to them? And part of the idea is, for me, is to slow down. Don't have to rush to make something, quote, better. Because I may not... there's so this other poem that helps with that. It's a poem written by Barbara McInerney. And it's, the poem is called As They Are. And it goes like this. And what if my words, my fledgling poems, were children, were toddlers, trying first steps, tumbling, skinning knees, with glee, splashing mud, making a mess, discovering themselves? Would I hold them at arm's distance, disown them, hide them, say what I imagine others will think, that after all, they really aren't very good? And could that be a way of protecting them, shielding, holding back? I know the mockery odd children can face. Instead, could I let them ramble along weedy paths only they know, lean close to hear them whisper secrets, learn what they need from me? Could I love them as they are, give them room to grow, a chance to shine? That third stanza, and could that be a way of protecting them, shielding, holding back? The sense of that I meet again and again, the resistance that people have, the fear they have sometimes of being able to express themselves.
Right.
Is because of this creative place in us is so much more important than recognizing. I mean, I asked people when they took a spelling test in fourth grade, you remember when you took your spelling test, did you prepare or not prepare? Did you cheat? You know, did you put on your wrist, you know, your words? And then, but before you took your test, did your teacher just ask you, which words on our list do you just enjoy the sound of? You know, do you just enjoy, like, skylark or scrumptious, you know, bungle? Isn't that a great word, bungle? I mean, and what I'm talking about is just the pleasure of language and the sounds, and that's what we really enjoy as children. And I think, I mean, the spelling test is one place where we begin to, words are like electric fence, you know, I'm going to get, like, charged from that, you know, red line. Or So the idea of playfulness and pleasure is another important part of safety, playfulness, pleasure. Sense of non-judgment. To me, in the long run, in the long run, that creates a much more stable and lasting creative environment. And then individuals, if individuals want, when they've gotten their, when their roots have been really fed, and they say, well, I'd really like to be able to look at this in a, another way, and I'd like your opinion on my writing, you know, or your sort of feedback. I think that that can really be useful, but in a way, I think we end up sort of shutting off the possibilities.
Right. I agree, and I think that what we're need, that what happens a lot of times in academic programs is there's such a push to produce, and you know, you need 10 poems this week, or you need a poem a day, or whatever. And I think that's important if you're going to be a professional poet. But I think if you're going to be someone who's enjoying your life, you know, the pleasure principle, you have to love it. You know, you have to love poetry in order to want to do it in any case. But I think that allowing just the pleasure of the words and pleasure of the language to come in means so much in both poetic medicine or in an academic setting. So we're going to take a little break again and come back, and then I'd like to talk more about some of your books, because you've got a couple of great ones here, and we'll be right back. With your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney. And I'm here with my guest, John Fox, who is the president of the Institute of Poetic Medicine in Palo Alto, and who's been all around the world teaching and people as a poetry therapist. He's an adjunct professor at CIIS, California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. He teaches at JFK University in Berkeley, the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology, or now SOPHIA University, and Holy Names University in Oakland. John's the author of two books, Poetic Medicine, The Healing Art of Poem Making, and has been featured on a PBS documentary called Healing Words, Poetry, and Medicine. His first book was called, what was it called? Finding What You Didn't Lose. And it's still in print, which is a great coup, actually. When you can have a book in print for a while, it's great. So, more about your books, John, because I was taken with poetic medicine as certainly as something that's important to me about how it has healed me and how it has helped my life. And I'd love to hear about your books and tell me
sure.
a little more. Yeah.
Sure. Back in the early, about 1993, I was hired to teach a course in the Graduate School of Psychology at John F. Kennedy University, and I had put together a course reader that was going to be used in that. I sort of went overboard. I mean, the course reader was about 350 pages.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it was, however, you know, I think Blake said something. Overabundance is actually, you know, can be a great boon. And so what I did was I thought I'd show my course reader to my friend who's on my board on the Institute for Poetic Medicine, Jim Fadiman, long-time friend, one of the founders, or sort of, he helped Bob Frazier start what was ITP, now known as Sophia.
Yes.
But so I showed this course reader to Jim, and the first thing he said upon looking at it was, you should make a copy of this and send it to Jeremy Tarcher, who's the publisher of my books, Jeremy P. Tarcher. And so what Jim didn't know is about 8 months previous to that, I had sent poems out of the blue to Jeremy Tarcher because I liked the books he published, even though he didn't publish poetry. And about a sent this sheaf of poems off to Jeremy Tarcher 8 weeks, 8 months before I showed Jim this course reader. Jeremy called me and he said, you know, we don't publish poetry. Poetry doesn't sell. But I like your poems, and I'm going to about to go on vacation. I'm going to take them with me. And so that was nice to have the publisher call. And then we had a long conversation about Poetry as Healer. So this is about 1992 or three, something about then. And and I learned at that time that Jeremy at that time was married to Sherry Lewis.
Yes.
Who's the puppeteer and Lamb Chop. And
right.
When I was growing up, I had puppets and
she was my heroine when I was a young person.
She was like, I remember watching her in 1962.
She was the Sesame Street.
She was with her ponytail and her red hair and her puppet. So, but anyway, Jeremy and I had a wonderful conversation, and he said, if you ever want a writing about that, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going through something, my personal life at that time was very difficult, and I didn't immediately just jump at the chance, but I wrote down the name of his assistant. And so then it was 8 months later where I showed this course reader to Jim, and he said, you should send it to Jeremy Tarcher. So well, guess what? And so then we did, sent the table of contents, and Jeremy got in contact, said, I'd like to talk to you about doing a book. And so that sort of got that going.
Mm-hmm.
And then he asked me to describe what my purpose was in this book, and essentially it was to say that there's a poet that's naturally in us, that is sort of we come with, and so, but we kind of get it taught out of us.
Mm-hmm.
So then in order to sort of show him this, I sent this little four lines from a poem by E.E. Cummings.
Mm-hmm.
And the poem goes, the trick of finding what you didn't lose, existing is tricky, but to live's a gift, the teachable imposture of always arriving at that place you never left.
Mm.
So that first line, the trick of finding what you didn't lose. So when I sent this letter to Jeremy, the first thing he did was write back and said, well, let's call it Finding What You Didn't Lose.
Mm-hmm.
You can always take a line from a poem if you're going to make it a title, a book title.
Right, right.
You don't even need permission to do
that. Oh, really? That's good to know.
That
was your first book.
That became the first book.
Uh-huh. And then the second book, Poetic Medicine.
It was like, I kept writing and writing, and Finding What You Didn't Lose is about making poetry part of your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the undercurrent, or the explicit idea that poetry is to be healing, but it's not completely about that. It's about making poetry part of your life. But there was one chapter in chapter 8 called The Healing Pulse of Poetry, and I just kept writing and writing and writing and writing that chapter. Finally, my editor, the wonderful Laura Golden Bilotti, threw up her hand and said, stop. And Jeremy even called me and said, you can't keep doing this. So he said, we'll just do another book.
Mm.
So that became when started on Poetic Medicine. That became Poetic Medicine.
Uh-huh.
And that was much more focused on the stories and experience I've had working with people and using poetry in a healing way.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have time?
Yeah, we've got a few more minutes. We've got about 5 minutes left.
Well, I feel like I want to give a direct experience of someone using this. This is in the book. It's in the chapter called When God Sighs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a chapter about loss and death and that sort of terrain that we really don't have many answers for, and that poetry can be helpful to because it provides a sense of so much paradox in those times. And poetry, one of its, I think, holds paradox in ways that the rational mind, generally speaking, can't handle, but the poem can.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a poem by a man named Bill Stephenson, and it's called Square Black Box. Square black box, tiny, lidded, empty, longtime companion. I'd asked people to think about some object they had that was dear to them. So this is square black box, tiny, lidded, empty, longtime companion, hard edged in my pocket, a gift remaining to me, though my wife has died, who was its giver. So long a companion, the lid has scratched dim. Hear me, relic and reliquary, holder of memory, even now, holder of her memory, even now. Hold my emptiness in yours, and from your darkness bring me that empties, that emptiness is truly infinite space, where all things are possible, where scratched and faded flowers blossom bright again, and where lost love is to be found again, and held in the grasp as safe and close as my fingers have when they hold tight to your four corners. And he said about writing this poem, the memories that had dimmed were suddenly vivid again, just as imagination had brought back the original colors of the flowers on the box lid. Memories of happy times of love came flooding back from their depths. I had thought to contain only pain and regret. The poem flowed into my notebook page naturally and unstoppably from this gift of realization. And that came from just a walk down a path during the workshop that I was giving at Omega Institute. And so Bill, instead of discussing what reaches him. I mean, I'm not going to, there's another place for that. And that was heard in the community of the people there. It's just such an important way to share our stories. Robin, would you want to read something?
Well, I would. I was just looking at what I had in my book, Heart Path, because I do have some poetry in it as well. And I was finding this one. It's called Rose Window. During the Black Plague, before medicine as we know it, families laid their sick ones beneath the colored windows of cathedrals. Better than we, that first there is the pierced heart, then the rearranging of light rays by that unseen hand as the sun moves across the glass. One must go inside, all the way in, surrendering all the broken pieces, taking long draws on straws of light, soaking in all colors, until you revive or move on within the stained glass sun.
But that line, I just mirror back this line, until you revive or move on. Like sometimes we sort of stop and take in a deep breath, and sometimes where it's like the flow, we just continue to flow.
Right. I'd heard this, that people used to lay their, in the medieval times, they would lay their people that were sick into the cathedrals under these windows. And when I heard that, I thought, what an act of faith. You know, that they somehow knew the colors were good for their family members, and some people got healed.
Yeah.
And others died, but at least, especially during the Black Plague, which was such a horrible time. But I thought of that, and it's a little bit like what happens with poetry for me, because when you go really deeply into yourself and you pull together those broken fragments and then out comes something beautiful, it's really quite an extraordinary experience.
And we can sort of, like a stained glass window, what is it called when you sort of use, you sort of piece them together in some way?
Yeah, I make a stained glass window. Yeah, I create the art of it. Yeah. Yeah, it's quite beautiful. Well, and you have a personal story, too, about how you were healed by poetry. And I didn't know if you wanted to touch on that or save it for another show.
Well, I think, yes. I grew up with a medical problem with my right leg that involved being in the hospital many times, having a number of surgeries, like seven, between the time I was 4 and a half and 18. And writing was an important way for me to make it through, for me to understand what was going on, to really find a way to hold that paradox, to be also, this is important, sort of revived. You mentioned the word revive in your poem, but by beauty. And even though I had to deal with some things were not very, you know, were really difficult and painful, I realized the poem gave me a way to tap into both sort of beauty and connection in a way that normal conversation wouldn't do. So it held both could hold both the pain, but also a sense of connection. Mm-hmm. So that, because when I was 18, I had to be faced with the decision to have my right leg below the knee amputated.
Mm-hmm.
And that began a whole sense of being able to understand what sort of intimately what loss is about and mm-hmm. what grief is about.
Mm-hmm.
And although at 18, it was not something I needed a year to really get to find some deeper sense of meaning about it.
The
poems and the poem making was a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, I met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in 1976, good fortune.
Wow.
And she invited me to come to a retreat she was giving. Mm-hmm. And I remember to that retreat, I took this hardback copy of poems by Rilke. And I still remember the gold emboss of the print on the spine of the book of poems by Rilke. And I don't think I knew at 20 that Rilke was sort of the poet about sort of coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And yet something in me knew that it was a companion.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place where I could come through.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know this one by Rilke? It goes, everything is close to my face.
Oh.
And everything close to my face is stone.
Boy, do I know that one. This is more than... Recently I had a great loss of my sister, Holly.
Mm-hmm.
And when I wrote to people about where I was just a week after her passing, I used those exact lines.
Oh, wow.
What I was feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the next lines in that are so powerful to me. Mm-hmm. It's you're
you be the
master. You be the master.
Break in. So your great grief cry happens to me. I don't know the lines exactly.
You be the master, make yourself fierce, break through, then your great grief cry will happen to you, will happen to me, or will happen to you, and your great transforming will happen to me.
Something
like that.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about Poetry as Healer is that I wasn't, and I'm only maybe beginning to be ready for those lines, but those earlier lines were what I needed.
Everything and close to my face is stone.
So again, that sense of slowing down.
Right.
But if people want to find out more, they're welcome to go to my website, poeticmedicine.org. Me at john@poeticmedicine.org. There's a training program that began last year. It's in its beginning stage, but it's going really well. And if people are interested in learning more about that, I'd welcome them to write to me.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, John. It's been a pleasure talking to you today, and I'm so delighted have this time, and I'm glad that we got to interview and talk to each other about this topic, because it's such a near and dear one to my heart. So I thank you, and this is the radio show Evolve with your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney, and I appreciate your cooperation, and thank you for listening. They'll see you next month.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for Convergence with John Caracella, Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Evolve was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE.